Thank you for tuning in to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. I'm Melanie Cogdill, Managing Editor of the Christian Research Journal. It's October 2020, and you're listening to episode 206, which is a conversation about evangelism in the suburbs. On this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Ashley Hales. Ashley has a PhD from the University of Edinburgh and is the author of Finding Holy in the Suburbs and the forthcoming book, A Spacious Life. She is also the host of the Finding Holy podcast. Ashley has written an effective evangelism article for the Christian Research Journal in our new Volume 43, Number 2 print issue of our journal, and her article is called How Do We Evangelize Affluent Suburbs? And you can read her article when you subscribe to the Christian Research Journal at our website, equip.org. Ashley, it's good to have you on.
Thank you so much, Melanie. It's a pleasure.
Well, we have been printing effective evangelism articles in the Christian Research Journal for many decades, but we have never covered this topic before, and that is evangelism in the context of suburbs. And it seems to me that right now, in general, in Christian ministry, there's a lot of focus on, you know, reaching out to cities and big, huge metropolitan areas, or, you know, those kinds of places, but still in the West, particularly. And so I would say this is mostly a Western phenomenon, probably, but especially in the United States, there is still the growth of the suburbs, which are, you know, basically bedroom communities that are a bit ways off from a commute into the main city center. So that will attract a certain kind of person that's living in the suburbs. So, you know, with that talk of kind of city center missions or overseas missions, why do you think that the suburbs are a strategic place for the gospel? Because a lot of times, I don't know that people really, they think that the suburbs are very conforming, or everybody seems the same. So why would you say, since you've written an article for us based on material in your book, why would you say that's strategic?
Yeah, you know, I think what's really fascinating about our view of suburbs is a lot of it, at least in America, tends to come like handed down to us from popular culture. You think of several movies where they kind of denigrate the suburbs, and you see this big, you know, swath of all of these tract homes that look exactly the same. And it's like, we kind of have this idea, at least in our media, that culture dies, right, in the suburbs, and that the kind of young hero needs to make himself known and go off to the city and find himself. And so I think a lot of times we've equated that has kind of filtered down into our practices of evangelism, that we focus on the city rather than the suburbs. And it's not to say that the city is less holy. That's a whole nother topic. But, you know, the suburbs are a strategic place for the gospel because, for firstly, there are people there. 50% of Americans live in the suburbs. Many people now, even with COVID-19, are kind of moving from expensive cities into suburban communities. And so the very fact that there are image bearers there means that we need to be bringing the good news of the gospel to suburbs. But also what's fascinating is the way that suburbs have been kind of characterized is really changing demographically. And so suburbs are actually, they can actually be more diverse than their metropolitan counterparts, particularly politically, which is fascinating. Is, you know, most large metropolitan cities tend to skew left, and most rural areas tend, in, at least in the US, right, tend to skew right. But usually you get a good mix in the suburbs. And so that means, I think, that the suburbs can be a place where we actually practice a lot of our gospel virtues, things like civility. And so as we kind of practice those things, we learn to be in proximity with people with very different ideas, not just politically, but lots of different things. I think it can be a way forward, and maybe even a model for other places that are a little bit more monolithic to live out the gospel here in suburbia.
Well, you're just mentioning that a lot of times, especially in America, we have this stereotype of what we think the suburbs are like. And I think for most of us, we probably think it's, you know, affluent Anglo people, white people that have two kids and they're involved in the PTA and that they're religious. You know, they've come to the suburbs because there's a lot of churches and it's very, like you said, the cookie cutter homes and that kind of, you know, image when we think of the suburbs or Leave It to Beaver and that kind of. If you said the word suburbs, I think in somebody's mental picture might think of that. But so why do you think a lot of Christians don't think of the suburbs as a place that needs to be evangelized?
I think you're right in that there's so much kind of cultural know-how that we kind of think of the suburbs as a moral place to be. And I actually was reading a book a while ago that actually talked about the literature from like the 1700s and 1800s, even in early America, that suburban spaces began to become like this area of more being equated with morality, you know, that if you lived in the suburbs, you were somehow better or, you know, had this sense of goodness about you. And so I think because of that, most people, we tend to just equate goodness with the gospel, with being a Christian. And really what though that's bred is this idea of kind of a consumer Christianity or, you know, a Christianity that I can take it or leave it, that I kind of go in and get my nice little inspirational message, or if I'm going through a hard time, I can go to the church. But we really aren't living lives of deep discipleship. And I think that's probably the case in all over, the, you know, America, I would say for sure. But I think, you know, so we kind of feel like, okay, the suburbs get a pass, that most people are upwardly mobile, they're decent people, they're good people. We use all these words to talk about suburban folks. And yet that is very different, right, from having a relationship with Jesus and being tied to your local church to serve in mission and ministry and mercy and justice where you are planted. And so I think part of it is even just recovering. What does it look like to be deeply formed as a Christian wherever you're placed, but then to also say that this doesn't necessarily look like just this upwardly mobile American affluent American dream. And that's not what it means to be a Christian. So some of it, we have to do a little bit of untangling before we're able to actually think through specific ways in which we can preach the gospel in the suburbs.
Well, you were just mentioning being upwardly mobile and affluent. And I think that's another stereotype about the suburbs is that people leave city center areas. Like if you think of city, you think of poverty maybe, or that stereotype. And if you think of the suburbs, you think of just more affluence that's there. So how would you say that, you know, this cultural view of affluence and maybe the stereotype of like, okay, everybody in the suburbs are these upwardly mobile, very affluent people that I can't relate to or wouldn't relate to me or wouldn't, you know, interact with me. How does that numb us to evangelism and to the gospel?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, I think we tend to think, at least in America or in affluent cultures, right, that we kind of have this idea of Jesus, the church, and our Christian faith as like a nice little cherry on top, or like a small rock in our bucket of rocks, and rather than the foundational stone around which our life is built. And when we kind of have this idea of our faith, or you know, our neighbor's faith as the cherry on top, what it looks like is we use all of our kind of tools of affluence instead to give us our identity, instead of Jesus Christ giving us our identity. And so what that looks like is we can see it in our time, you know, in the suburbs, particularly before COVID. You know, there were people running around all of the time, right? Their kids were in every extracurricular activity. They were playing every sport all through the weekend. And these were the ways in which they found their identity and, you know, their vacations. And, you know, the upgrades on the house, at least where I am, that is an affluent neighborhood here in the suburbs, that was the way in which people found their identity. And what's hard about that is that often that doesn't run out. So it wouldn't be until, you know, someone's marriage was on the brink or they had lost a job, that we in our local church would be able to actually connect with them and tell them about the good news of Jesus. And so I think, unfortunately, when we have so many resources at our disposal, even though, of course, we are all broken and dealing with internal angst and sin, it can take a long time, even just for some of those things to run out where a person sees their need for Jesus.
Well, one thing I want to also ask you about is, you know, I think we think of places that are affluent to be somehow protected, or places where people are not dealing with, like, say, things like drug addiction. You think of drug addiction and you think of, oh, okay, that happens in the urban areas. That would not happen in suburban areas. And so what have you learned about just affluent communities and mental health? And, you know, a couple of years ago for the school that I'm at, they had parents read different books. And one of the books that we read is now, boy, it's almost been 10 years, was a book written back in 2011 called Hurt 2.0. And what was interesting about it was in there, they were saying that some of the kids in the affluent suburbs were more at risk or equally at risk as some of the kids from very, you know, difficult areas, very urban areas where their parents were not involved in their lives. And I thought that was a very interesting kind of observation that they found out from this various different surveys and data that they were looking at, that sometimes we wouldn't think of at-risk people in the suburbs. So can you address that? What about those kinds of things and issues like mental health and things that we don't think of when we think of affluence and the suburbs?
Yeah. Well, there's a book by Madeline Levine called The Price of Privilege, How Parental Pressure and Material Advantage Are Creating a Generation of Disconnected and Unhappy Kids. And it was just such a wake-up call for me, because she writes about how there's an inverse relationship between income and closeness to parents. And yet these parents who have all of the everything, you know, we think of as kind of the American dream, a bunch of money, maybe, you know, a ticket to a good college, that these parents have a tremendous amount of pressure on their own children. And then coupled with so much financial resources, that actually the children are growing up, like you said, more at risk for mental health disorders, particularly anxiety and depression and suicide and suicidal ideation, that this is actually causing our children in this coming generation to actually be more at risk exactly than the inner city kids. And so she comments actually that the single most important thing that a family can do is actually have dinner together. And I thought that is such a beautiful way. And, you know, this is just a kind of a sociological researcher, but such a beautiful picture of what the gospel invites us into, right? Is just a meal around the table. And even just having dinner in our homes where kids feel safe and heard and they can bring all of their messiness is one way in which we can actually begin to push back against some of that narrative, some of that pressure, so that whatever our kids are struggling with, whatever we're struggling with, like that there's a safe container for that, and that we can again also bring that to Jesus, you know, in our local communities and in our local churches.
That's an interesting point about that book. And as a matter of fact, that was another book that they had suggested a few years ago for parents to read at the school where my kids attend, The Price of Privilege. But in addition, just to make that note, that in the last couple of years, I've seen a lot of the seminars for parents to help their kids cope have all been about anxiety and depression and, you know, pressure. And so it seems to be that it is a very real thing that the kids are communicating to teachers and other, you know, staff members and counselors and so forth. So that's interesting. So thinking about some of those things that we've just kind of set the stage of, you know, what is suburbia like, or how is it different than we think it is? What are some practices of evangelism that you would say are unique to reaching people in the suburbs?
You know, I think a lot of it is in the city, you have these pretty defined kind of third spaces, places that aren't your home or your work, where people meet and interact and mingle. Think of like a New York subway, or, you know, if you have a downtown bookstore or pub that people congregate at, there's places that are natural where you can actually meet people and to begin to develop relationships that are safe and you're not like inviting a stranger right away into your home for a meal. But the suburbs doesn't tend to have that. The suburbs tend for people, you know, to be in their big cars with the air conditioning, they're driving everywhere, and then they can pull right into their, you know, garage, close the garage, maybe a nice polite wave to a neighbor. And so the challenge then, I think, for suburban Christians is to find some of those third spaces and to create some buffer in your own kind of natural weekly rhythms for that third space interaction with neighbors. Because obviously, if we're going to be able to be embedded in our community, to know the needs of our community, we have to understand our community and actually know real people and not just, you know, think about evangelism like abstractly. And so some of the practices that my husband and I have done, my husband's a pastor, is we have tended to prioritize walking our neighborhood. And so thankfully, where we are, there's a lot of lovely walking paths and wide sidewalks. And so we've really taken advantage of those, not just to kind of exercise our children, but, you know, to actually pay attention to the needs of our neighborhood. You can notice what's in disrepair, how you might actually, you know, involve yourself maybe in acts of mercy. You can also get to know the same people, right, that you pass by. Excuse me. You can also stay in, kind of decide, I'm going to be a front yard Christian instead of a backyard Christian. Choose to be out front. Choose to have some of those beginning conversations with neighbors to develop trust, to develop friendship, develop relationships, so that you're then being able to actually invite people into your home and practice hospitality. I think hospitality is also a really wonderful practice of evangelism because, at least where I am, most people think of having people over as a form of entertaining, right? And let's see our gorgeous kitchen remodel, or you can watch, you know, pictures of our latest trip. But to invite people into your actual home with a little bit, you know, with your actual mess, is something that really increases vulnerability with people. And in the area, in affluent areas where people want to kind of put up the wall and pretend that things are okay, showing your own vulnerability is a really great on-ramp into gospel conversations.
And I would say right now, you know, we find ourselves still in certain restrictions because it's 2020 and it's COVID. But I, in my neighborhood, that's the most people I've ever seen out walking, like walking their dogs and, you know, whole families before you might see one spouse or the other, or you wouldn't see that many people at all. And it just seems like just the average neighborhood streets are just, you know, teeming with people that normally aren't there. So there's probably some other opportunities that we normally don't have before COVID.
Yeah, I think so. I think that's exactly right. There's, you know, everyone's out, everyone's stir crazy. And so it's a really great opportunity to get to know the people right around you.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Dr. Ashley Hales, who has written an effective evangelism article from the print edition of the Christian Research Journal in our current Volume 43, Number 2 issue. And her article is called How Do We Evangelize Affluent Suburbs? And you can read it when you subscribe for $33.50 to the print issue of the Christian Research Journal at our website, equip.org. Now, of course, I'm going to ask you to partner with us. The easiest way that you can do that is just simply tell a friend about this podcast or share this episode on your social media accounts. But would you mind giving us a written review wherever you get your podcasts or at Apple Podcasts? I'm going to read you the most recent review, which is back in August. So it's now October. We would love to see a current new review for us. You can easily give us a starred review or write a couple of sentences. And this is the review from LLW1988 titled, Love This. I love the book reviews. I'm really interested in refuting postmodern Christianity. Conversations on this podcast are very doctrinally sound. Thank you, learning so much. So if you could take a moment to head on over to Apple Podcasts to give us a review or rate the podcast, we'd be most grateful. The other thing that you can do is to give us a tip. You can easily do that for a small amount, like $3, $5, $10, if you don't have $33.50 for a subscription. And please head on over to our website, equip.org, under magazine. The second choice of the drop-down menu is Postmodern Realities Podcast. Click on that. And if you go to any landing page, you will find the link where you can give us a tip. And thank you for the many ways that you support this podcast to help us continue to bring you this free content. Well, I'd like to ask you specifically, you know, when we're talking about evangelism, if you've seen people who have come to Christ and you've seen, you know, changes in their lives. I think there are times when, you know, like we're talking about, we have these stereotypes of the kinds of people that live in suburbs, and we think those people would never become Christians. So I'd love to hear a story about, you know, you mentioned your husband's a pastor, about you witnessing somebody's life in the suburbs that has been changed because of the gospel.
Yeah. You know, we have some neighbors, and it was a great, it was a very easy way to get to know them. They were really fun and enjoyable. And my husband is one way to just kind of get to know the community, signed up as kind of a neighborhood representative. And there's this other man, Jason, who is also a neighborhood representative. And so it was really easy for us, of course, this was pre-COVID, to, you know, invite them, Jason and Stephanie and their two kids, into our home, just to provide a place of welcome. And it was so great just to begin that friendship. And then after a few months, and they reciprocated, which was really kind, and we had dinner over at their house, and we were just across the street, and so it was really easy to continue that sort of relationship. They began to ask questions about my husband's work, which is always a great conversation. You know, the conversation can get deep real quick. And so my husband starts telling them about what does it look like to be a pastor. Both of these folks had kind of nominal Christian upbringings, but weren't walking with Jesus, didn't really have a great relationship with God or the church. But then they were kind of taken aback, like, oh, you actually believe that sort of stuff? Okay. And we continued hanging out. We'd hang out with our kids, or they rode bikes in the alley. And then, you know, maybe 6 months later, Jason's like, you know, I think we really would love to come to your church. And so they have come to church. They came consistently. He's a firefighter, and she would even come and bring the kids when he was working. And it became a way then, as we were able to kind of enfold them into the life of the church, get them connected with other members, that they began to actually trust Jesus. And they, you know, started asking us questions about kids in Sunday school and how do I teach them the Bible? And we gave them a copy of the Jesus Storybook Bible. And to see these people who had simply kind of been all about the fun and the experiences actually come to know Jesus and have a deeper reality and a deeper grounding was really a beautiful thing.
Well, in my neighborhood, I also live in a suburb. We had a couple that moved in a few years ago, and she's actually from China, and her husband, I don't know where he's from. He's from like Yugoslavia or something like that. So they are not native to the America. And so we've just gotten to know them, and it was interesting. For a couple of years, we hosted a student who goes to our school, who is a exchange student from China, who's not a Christian or anything. And one time his parents were visiting and I took them over there just to, you know, meet her and stuff. And she specifically said, oh, you know, she thought our family was so helpful. She said, Melanie's so helpful. I think that's because she's a Christian. So it was kind of interesting to me because she related just me trying to be a friend to her. And actually, out of all my neighbors, and she's totally not a Christian, she's the one, she needs something, she will, you know, email me or text me. Or I've had some issues with my washing machine where I've like lugged wet laundry over there to use her dryer, and she's done that. And we've had them over a couple of times for some holidays, for Thanksgiving. And so it is sometimes, you know, a step of faith, because especially, you know, there's not a context maybe where you know your neighbors. Sometimes you have friends because you know them from work or maybe you go to the gym together or something, but your neighbors are just like kind of no context because they're just strangers that moved in next to you. So it just is always really interesting to try to establish some relationships and friendships with your neighbors.
You know, and we've had, just to encourage the listeners too, like we've had so many awkward conversations with, you know, neighbors that we've invited to dinner. And, you know, it's like some of them you kind of hit off naturally with and some you don't, but it's still great to practice hospitality, right? And to be that helpful neighbor, like you were saying.
So one thing I wanted to mention to our listeners is that the article that you can read that Ashley wrote, if you subscribe to the magazine, you can do that on our website, equip.org, is she revised some of that material to make a much shorter article for us, but is based on material in a book that she wrote called Finding Holy in the Suburbs. So just in our conversation, did you feel prompted? What was the reason why you wrote this book? Because that seems like just a really unique topic. Why would you want to look at how to reach people with the gospel in the suburbs?
Yeah, well, a lot of it came out of our own move to the suburbs. My husband and I moved back home to suburbia. We grew up in suburbia about 5.5 years ago. And so I was trying to reckon with my place. And a lot of my lived experience, we've kind of lived all over in Western United States. We've lived in cities, and we did our graduate degrees overseas in Scotland. And then also during this time, you know, kind of early 20s, we were enamored with all the kind of city center language about church planting. And so we thought, like, yes, we're going to plant a church in a city center and, you know, discuss ideas and, you know, help out with issues of poverty and justice. And then God led us back to the suburbs. And so I really had to reckon with how places form our loves and desires, rather than, you know, seeing my place as kind of this way of self-actualization. And so it was in that struggle between, I don't really feel like a suburban person, you know, all these sorts of stereotypes that we already spoke about, and then realizing, well, the gospel is good news. So how do I actually apply the gospel to where I am and not necessarily try to just chafe about where I am? And what does the gospel look like in a particular place? And here I am in the suburbs. So what does it look like here?
So in your book, you talk about various different idols in suburban culture. So what are some of those idols that people have? Like, what are some of the most prominent ones that you think people wrestle with?
Yeah, you know, I think this is probably in most kind of affluent cultures, and it kind of has tended to be the way in which our country now is kind of headed. But these are the kind of, when I talk about idols, I'm talking about, what do we look to for our identity other than Christ? And, you know, how do we kind of follow these instead of the kind of paths of spiritual formation that the church offers to us? And the four I mentioned in my book are the idea of consumerism, which is the idea that I can kind of buy my way into the good life. And so what, you know, what we amass, what we accumulate, how nice our cars are, that these are sorts of things that signify that we mean something. And the second is individualism. And this kind of looks like often the sense that I get to do whatever I want to do. I can live a life without constraints here in suburbia. And so I'm going to look out for myself, number one, and maybe, you know, if I have a family, my nuclear family as well. And so we lack the kind of communal formation in the local church. And instead, we kind of look to satisfy our own desires. And then the third one, I think, is the idea of busyness. And really, that's just, you know, a function of our time. We think like, oh, we're busy. But it's not just simply kind of a state of our, you know, our schedule or what our calendars look like, but that busyness actually can numb us, like I was saying, to the ways that affluence is actually infecting our souls. in that, because we're busy, because we're hurried, we actually don't learn how to lament. We don't get in touch with the deep wells of sin in our lives. We don't actually feel the overwhelming power of grace, because we just keep running around because we're probably afraid that if we stop, we don't know what we're going to find there, which is an interesting kind of tie to COVID. I think as we've stopped, a lot of stuff has come to the surface nationally, as well as individually and communally, that we really need to deal with. And then the fourth idol is safety. And I think, of course, we need to be safe. That's part of what it looks like to be a flourishing community. But the idolization of safety, particularly, I think, with parents and children, means that children aren't able to kind of enter into meaningful risk. They're not able to work at failure very well. And we see some of that, of course, in kind of the increased prominence of mental health problems of children in the suburbs. But we also know that safety when it becomes an ultimate good, then kind of blinds us towards empathy and compassion and hospitality to our neighbors. And so these are kind of, I don't know, they're the four horsemen of the suburban apocalypse. I don't know. But, you know, these are things that kind of blind us from the goodness of the gospel that really allow kind of breaks down those idols.
So in your book, you talk about counter liturgies to these suburban idols. So what do you mean by counter liturgies? What is that to you? And what would that look like? What would it look to counter some of these suburban idols?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of talk, like liturgy is a cool buzzword, even though it's a very old word. But, you know, the idea of a liturgy, right, is a kind of a formative story. And so when we talk about like the liturgy of our Sunday morning worship, you know, this is the story that we're entering into on a Sunday morning, that we rehearse these things, you know, the call to worship, a confession of sin. We celebrate the Lord's Supper. We have a sermon. We're singing. We're praying. We're sent out with good word, with a benediction. And so if we think about a liturgy as a formative story, what are the ways in which we kind of have this, you know, suburban liturgy, right? It might be some of those four idols that I mentioned. And so what can we do as Christians to counter that liturgy? And often, as we know, the life of the believer is lived in very small moments. Annie Dillard said, you know, the way that you spend a day is how you spend your life. And so I think that it's really important to think about what kind of small activities, what formative experiences, what am I doing that's going to actually counter, that's going to form me into the way of Jesus instead of kind of this suburban liturgy. And so what that might look like, for instance, in my chapter on hospitality, which is kind of a counter liturgy to kind of some of this individualism and consumerism, rather than focus on myself, rather than focusing on what I buy, I'm going to actually open up my home and welcome people in. But yeah, a counter liturgy might be like to committing to practices of hospitality and starting with your most close neighbors, which might be the people in your own family or a roommate, and choosing to eat dinner together. It might be look like you're blocking off your calendar to counteract busyness so that it doesn't get kind of filled up unthinkingly. Or you choose to say, what are the things that we are going to value? Or how many nights can we be out? What is a healthful way to proceed as a family so that we're not simply existing, you know, for the good of the members of our family, but that our family is actually something that we are a form, right? That we are using to love our neighbors, to love our communities, to be for the life of the world.
So how should churches think differently about evangelism when they, you know, when you're thinking through some of the issues that you're mentioning in your book, especially as it relates to, you know, there's a fair number of churches in the suburbs. So how should they think differently about evangelism? Not so much, okay, it's evangelism is these mission trips we're going on. How should reaching the suburbs, you know, form a little bit more of their vision for what evangelism looks like in their local community?
Right. I think that's a great point. I think we can tend to think of, you know, evangelism as like I go over somewhere far away and do something kind, and then I come home and still live my life. But rather to think of evangelism as a way in which we operate, just the kind of the fruit of our own spiritual disciplines and our life in our communities, families, and churches. And so I think it's, you know, as we think about how could churches think about discipleship and evangelism differently in suburbia, a lot of it looks like just encouraging our people to ask good questions about how they spend their time and their money. Those are real good kind of markers about the state of our souls, I think, is, you know, what are we giving our attention to and what are we giving our money to? And then to also ask people to maybe sit with some of those questions, choose to actually get to know their places. I always like to talk about walking, eating, and praying as kind of a three-prong way to look at your life in your neighborhood. And some of this came out of the book called The Art of Neighboring, which is a really helpful way to think about neighborhood evangelism. But, you know, to actually commit to walking your neighborhood, to commit to eating with people in your neighborhood, because community is always formed around food, and to be praying for gospel conversations to be opening and to walk in them, right? When the doors begin to open. So I think that would just be kind of the very first start. I think there's a lot of great books, like my own book. I have kind of church discussion guides. And, those can be really helpful, too, to help people think about it. But a lot of it has to be with how are we helping people know that evangelism isn't something that they just do as a one-off sort of thing, but it's actually kind of the fabric of the Christian life. And so a lot of it just looks like first analyzing the ways in which we failed and then saying, okay, what are the good kind of very small steps that I can take to begin to walk in that way?
Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid fire questions for Ashley.
Okay.
So speaking of the suburbs, Starbucks pumpkin spice latte, yes or pass?
Pass.
Introvert or extrovert?
Introvert.
Early bird or night owl?
Early bird.
And what is a favorite thing you like about living in the suburbs?
It really has to do with walking. We have a lot of trails, a lot of wide sidewalks, and I do enjoy the fact that I can let my kids roam a little bit and not be worried that they're going to get run over by cars. So that is one beautiful thing.
Well, thanks, Ashley, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
You are so welcome. It's been such a pleasure.
You've been listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest has been Dr. Ashley Hales, who has written an effective evangelism article called How Do We Evangelize the Affluent Suburbs? And you can read it in the current print edition of the Christian Research Journal, which is volume 43, number 2. You can subscribe to our journal for $33.50 at our website, equip.org, to read Ashley's article. And thank you.